Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. My name is Ralph, and I am an alcoholic. That welcome is just incredible. When you're up here, you don't know. I've never experienced anything like that. It's so unlike. I was in Concord, California, a number of years ago, and I was sitting, and I was going to a meeting kind of like this on a Saturday evening, and I was real nervous, and I was trying to act cool and just look cool, and that's real hard to do when you're not. And two guys came up to me, and said, one fellow says, "Are you the Ralph that's speaking this evening?" And I said, "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am." And I stood up, I was going to introduce myself, and he turned to his pal and he said, "It's the wrong Ralph, let's go." I looked over at my host, and he went like that. These guys walked right out of the auditorium, and my heart just sank. And he went like that. He'd put them up to it. And it was his way of welcoming me to Concord, California. And on careful consideration between the two, I prefer yours. When I saw our beautiful Al-Anon speaker, Linda, later after the program, and she was talking about, she was from Minneapolis, and she had been up to Moorhead, and I thought about some of the beautiful people that you meet in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're not all alcoholics. And I was sitting at the head table, kind of like this, only it was down just a little bit lower. It was a Saturday night at that Red River thing up there in Moorhead, and I was sitting next to the pastor's wife. The mayor was there, and his wife, and the pastor, some minister, had given the invocation, and I was sitting next to the pastor's wife, and she was one of these just incredibly beautiful ladies that you meet, and she says, "Ralph, what's your last name?" I says, "Bruxis." She says, "What nationality is that?" I said, "Well, it's Norwegian." She said, "Do you ever tell ethnic stories?" I said, "Well, no, as a matter of fact, I don't. I never tell them because I'd rather walk over hot coals than take a chance and offend anybody. I never tell them." She said, "Well, where are you from?" I said, "Well, I'm from Seattle." She said, "Well, do they tell ethnic stories out there?" And I said, "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, they do." And she said, "What kind?" I said, "Well, they tell Polish stories and Italian stories, all kinds of stories. Why?" She says, "Back here in Minneapolis," she says, "all of our ethnic stories are Norwegian stories." And she says, "As a matter of fact, I have one for you." And I said, "Hey, wait a minute, I just told you I'm Norwegian." And she says, "I'll tell it real slow." And she proceeded to clear up a real mystery for me. She said, they're drafting the men now in Norway at 48th. And I said, "Why is that?" She said, "They want to get them right out of high school." yeah, that's enough of that. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody had told me one time that early on that all of life is written on the back of my eyeballs. All of life was pretty much an inside job. And I kind of have agreed with that in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm especially in AA meeting. It could be a beautiful experience, or it could be 8 miles of bad road, but it's pretty much my choice. And a friend of mine was introducing a CPA, as a non-alcoholic, had nothing to do with AA a number of years ago, and he told a little story, short, brief little story that's been, I hadn't heard it then, it was about 10, 12 years ago, and I've read it, heard it many times since then. But when I heard it, I said, "That's the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the way it is, especially in meetings." And he went on to introduce his CPA, but he was talking about the guy who's going to start a new company, and somebody said, "You better find a CPA." And he did, he found a CPA. He said, "Before I hire, I'd like to ask a question." He said, "Fine." He said, "How much is 2 plus 2? Remember the story? He says, "Well, it's 4. He says, "Fine, maybe in touch. Find another CPA before I hire, I'd like to ask a question." He said, "Fine." He says, "How much is 4 plus 4? He says, "Well, it's 8. He said, I may be in touch. Found out a CPA. He said, before hiring, I'd like to ask a question. He said, fine. He said, how much is 8 plus 8? The CPA sat back in his chair and said, what would you like it to be? It's an old story. But that's the way it is for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's pretty much an inside job. There aren't any rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've embraced a couple, three things that have really, that have helped me. There aren't any rules. Somebody was asking an attorney. He said that he's always one. He was a lawyer. He was a pleasant, positive, cheerful, optimistic, enthusiastic sort of a lawyer, in spite of the fact that he was dealing with alcoholics, he was dealing with the unwashed, the unloved, the unlovable. Always pleasant, upbeat. Whenever you saw him and somebody asked him, he said, how in the world are you dealing with these alcoholics, the unwashed, the unloved? He said, how do you remain so cheerful? He says, well, I have three rules. He said, rule number one, always get the money up front. And rule number two is, I must remember that if we lose the case, it's him that's going to slam, not me. And rule number three, always get the money up front. And I've embraced three rules for myself, or three points of view that sort of formed the cornerstone of my sobriety. And one was that I didn't want to die yet. And somehow, one day at a time, I could never, ever drink again. And the third was I had to learn how to be nicer to people. And there aren't any rules. But if there's some people that are newer, there may be some things that make sense. And I heard it many years ago when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is that when you share your experience and your strength, and the guy said, he said, I'm just a letter carrier. I'm just a letter carrier. And if for whatever reason they think it's junk mail, it's okay. And that's part of carrying the message. And one of the things that I found when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was talking at a little assembly recently up in my part of the world, we were talking about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was on this little panel and with a couple of other fellows, and when I came out of the meeting, there was a fellow outside the meeting, he must have been about 6'12". He was a big guy. He said, you were just in that meeting in there, weren't you? And I looked up at him. I said, well, yes, matter of fact. He said, you were on that panel, weren't you? And I said, well, yes, as a matter of fact. And you ever notice when a guy's real big how your tone sort of softens when you talk to him? I said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I was. He said, they were talking about signing those court slips in there, weren't they? I said, well, yeah. He says, I'm against it. How do you feel about it? He says, it misleads people. He says, when they're sent to Alcoholics Anonymous like that, it gives them the wrong impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was sort of strident, firm in his opinion. He says, how do you feel about it? And I looked up at him, and I said, well, some of my friends are for it, and some of my friends are against it, and I guess I'm with my friends. It was an old line. He didn't laugh. He didn't get it. And I thought back. I wanted to tell. I said, listen, you're talking to the wrong guy. That's how I came to Alcoholics. Now, I didn't come through the courts. They weren't doing that then. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I came through the back door. But I thought of a dear, dear friend of mine that I met when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here, I had a lot of jail time still pending. And after I was sober about 4 months, I dropped the appeal, and I ended up in the police farm for alcoholics. And I was supposed to do it downtown, and the last time I was sentenced just to 6 months. But I was supposed to do it downtown, but anyhow, I ended up in the police farm for alcoholics. And I met a guy. I'd been sober now in AA 4 months when I dropped the appeal. And then I started doing my time. And I met a beautiful guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, a beautiful person. He was a banjo player. And he played in some of our things there in Seattle around the Pacific Northwest. His name was Frank. He kind of looked like Hoagy Carmichael. In all modesty, he said there's a few things that he played better than Eddie Peabody, the banjo king of the world. Just a few things. And I really liked Frank. He was just a simple, quiet, beautiful guy. And one day, the Saturday, they were bringing the new prisoners out from downtown. And as they brought the prisoners out, they sent them through the delousing and then through the shower and then get them overalls and chambray shirt and the jacket. And then they coming out, and I was seeing if any of my pals were in the lineup there. And here comes my friend Frank. Now, Frank had been sober for a year and a half. Sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a year and a half. And he was embarrassed to see me. And we're sitting on the edge of a bunk and kind of neither looking at each other, just smoking a cigarette, looking down at the floor. I said, Frank, why'd you get drunk? And he said, I started getting resentments. He says, I started getting resentments, and I would hear somebody up there in front, and I'd think to myself, you phony. And I'd hear something, and it would just bother me. And then he said, I stopped going to meetings. And the next thing you know, I got drunk. I said, well, how come they give you so much time? Well, how long you got? He said, you got 30 days, but they had a bunch of old stuff out on me, and that's why I'm here. And I wish it had ended there, but Frank continued. He didn't make it. He never sobered up again. The next time I saw him, he had slipped again, and I bumped into him at the Alano Club. And the next time after that I saw him, he was missing. He had a patch on his right eye. And then the next time after that I saw him, We talked about something. We talked about the police farm and some other things. We talked about the banjo. We talked about various things. And he got around to 12 o'clock. He started over again. He started playing the tape over again in about 15 minutes. And I realized that his mind had gone. And mercifully, he died. And I wanted to tell the big guy, hey, listen, they want to send him. It doesn't make any difference how they send him. As long as they come here. And as long as we have an opportunity to be with them. Because as when we're here and we get too full of what we believe ourselves, we kind of get confused. And I wanted to tell them, and I'll call it General Electric because they're not here to defend themselves. But anyhow, General Electric was going to hold their annual sales meeting, and the number one salesman in the country says, I ain't going. He says, why ain't you going? He says, same old warmed over pablum. The guy had a resentment. He says, I've heard it all before. He says, I ain't going. His boss called him and he says, you going to that sales meeting? You going to the annual sales meeting? He says, I ain't going. He says, how come? He says, I've heard all that stuff before. Boss says, I tell you what, you either go to that sales meeting or you're going down the road. He says, I'll go. Meeting convened at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 11 o'clock, he'd had all that pleasure he could stand. He goes out of the grand ballroom, across the lobby, into the cocktail lounge, and he orders a double scotch, 11 o'clock in the morning, sitting there nursing the double scotch. A very distinguished-looking gentleman, like Don, sitting back there. He came in and sat down, dark, three-piece suit, handsome, orders an orange juice. Turns to the salesman, he says, what brings you here? He's on with General Electric, and we got a sales meeting, and there's all boring old stuff. He says, I've heard all that stuff before. As a matter of fact, 11:15, we got some guy from corporate. They never know what's coming down. They're worse than anybody. Took a little drag on his scotch. He says, what brings you here? Distinguished. He got other guys as well. Small world. As a matter of fact, he says, I'm the chairman of the board of General Electric. And at 11 o'clock, 11:15, I'm going to address them. It was real quiet. Salesman without looking up, he said, you and I have a great deal in common. And how so? He says, we've both gone about as far in this company as we're ever going to go. Well, that's what I was going to tell the big guys. God, I don't want to sit out there. I don't want to get all hung up with resentments because there's so much to learn and so much to experience. You see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came through the back door. But it didn't start then. It started. I was an enlisted man in the Navy, and I was so impressed when Creighton was talking earlier today, and he was an officer and a pilot and all that, and I was an enlisted man. And I was stationed up in Washington State, and Whidbey Island was the most beautiful duty in the whole United States Navy, at least on the West Coast. And I got a lot of trouble, and had problems with my alcoholism then, and they shipped me out to Guam, in the South Pacific. I went from the best duty in the United States Navy to what was perceived as the worst duty. And I'd only been on the island about 3 or 4 days, and they caught me passed out on the lawn in front of I was supposed to be working, and I passed out on the lawn and from too much drinking, and put me on report. I was up to see the captain. He gave me a couple weeks restriction, and that was the first time I was to see him. And for the next year and a half, or 18 months, I saw him many times. We had many visits together, and we talked mainly about various things that interested him. We didn't have a whole lot in common. We didn't know any of the same people except my friends. And after about a year and a half, I only had 6 months left to do in the Navy. I was not going to make it my career. I only had 6 months left to do. And I was supposed to go home after a year and a half. That's all you had to do out there on that island. And as it worked out, they were going to extend me for another 6 months and let me finish my tour of duty there. But they came out with an all-Navy bulletin that says anybody who would agree to extend for 1 year, if you're selected, they'll send you back to the States for 30 days of shore duty, 30 days of leave, and then you get shore duty someplace in the United States. And I was engaged to a beautiful young lady, and I was really pretty anxious to get home. I'd been in a lot of trouble out there, and I was anxious to get home. And out of all the guys who agreed to extend, mine was the only shore duty that came in. Matter of fact, I can still recall like it was yesterday. I came in from the work area and got off the truck, and the master at arms met me. And Ernie says, "Ralph, congratulations. Out of all the guys who agreed to extend, yours is the only shore duty that came in. You check out tomorrow, Friday. You go up to the Naval Air Station, you fly to Hawaii, and then you're going home." And after a year and a half out there, that was good news. And I realized that I was going to give up an extra year of my life, and that was fine. I thought it was a good exchange. About 9:20 that night, I was a base movie operator besides my regular job, daytime job, and I had a hustle, and it was good because they paid me an extra $3 a day, and I didn't have to stand any night watches. It was just a good scam. And that night, it was going to be my last night checking out. It was wonderful. About 9:20, the phone rang. Just as I was securing the movie. And it was my friend Fred Geyer from Los Angeles, California. Fred was not an alcoholic. He had the bunk right next to me. He was also one of the Navy's problem children. He was in the brig. He was a general court-martial prisoner in the brig. He was not an alcoholic, but he had another little problem. He used to steal things from the Navy. He used to steal cases of ham and steak and turkey and other food, and he sold it to the restaurants up in Agana. And when they caught him, they were upset. They were naturally upset, and they awarded him a general court-martial, and he was in the brig. But they transferred him over to the dispensary. He says, "Ralph," he says, "I'm sick, I'm in the dispensary, psychiatric observation." He says, "Come and get me, we'll go up the road, and we'll have a few drinks." I said, "You can't believe this. I'm checking out tomorrow. I'm flying out Sunday." He says, "Great. Come on, get me. I'll be waiting for you in the shadows outside sick bay." And I did. I picked him up. We went up the base, went up the road, and up to one of the villages, and we drank till about 12:30. Coming back down, we said, "Hey, you want to get a hamburger?" "Sure." Stopped at a little drive-in right there outside of Agana. Stopped at a little drive-in, and just had rolled down the window. The waitress had come over, and she put the tray on there, and she'd taken her order, and neither one of us were very intoxicated. And I looked in the rear view mirror, and I looked back, and I noticed that there was all kinds of Armed Services Police Detachment vehicles. And they had lined off the whole driveway, and they'd spread out and fanned out, and they were checking. What they were checking for was all the enlisted men who were not married had to be off the streets, had to be snugged up in the lily whites by 11 o'clock at night if you weren't married, living off base. So I just thought I was going to try to con my way out of it. He come up, and young Marine said, "What are you doing here?" And then he looked in. And what we didn't know was that they had an all-island pickup out on my friend Fred. Every half an hour, they had a bunk check on Fred, and within 29 minutes, they knew he was gone. They knew he was someplace on that island. They knew he wasn't where he was supposed to be. And that young Marine looked in, and Fred, he was big too, and he'd been in the brig so long by this time that all the Marines down at our end of the island knew him. And that young Marine looked in, and he saw Fred, and he recognized him, and had been on the radio, the armed services, everybody, the shore patrol, the civilian police, marshals, everybody was looking for him on that island. And that young Marine got excited. And I didn't think much about it at the time, but those 45s they carry, they're not loaded. And he's got this thing, he pulls it out, and right in front of him, he slams that clip in that thing and cocks that thing, and then, well, the next thing I know, Fred is back in the brig, and I'm right in the next cell to him. And that's where I was. My best buddy got my shore duty the next day, and I was in the brig with my friend Fred. They kept me locked up and on restriction for a couple of months, and I lost the shore duty, but I didn't have to do the extra year. They're going to drop all the charges against me, all except a couple of minor charges, and they're going to let me coast out. And the day I'm to go to my hearing, my preliminary hearing, the mast, I leave my work area. I said, Chief, I got to go up and get cleaned up at about 8:30. My mast, 1 o'clock. He says, fine, Ralph, get some rest. Because I've been drunk for about 3 or 4 days, and he said, you look terrible. Get some clean whites and shave. And he said, get squared away. I said, okay. Now, what's an alcoholic going to do? One of the biggest things he's ever done, and you got a hearing coming up, and it looks like it's going to work out. What's he going to do? What do you need? I need just a couple drinks to kind of get settled down. So instead of going back to the barracks, I go down to a little village, and I sit there from about 8:30 in the morning to about 11:30 drinking whiskey and getting ready to go to mass at 1 o'clock. I'm going through the Marine gate, and to this day, I swear that Marine flagged me through, that little signal they had when they flick you through the gate. Later testimony at the trial indicated he had not flagged me through. And, of course, there was the nemesis sitting right back here. And the Marine in the Armed Services Police Detachment, they got me again. And at 1 o'clock when I was supposed to see the captain, I was down sick bay, and the doctor was determining that I was drunk by his standards. And I did get to see the captain finally later after I got sobered up, and a couple weeks later, and he awarded me another court-martial, and I went back to, by this time they'd shipped Fred back to the United States to federal prison, and they put me back in the brig, and I coasted out and came back to the States and got married. Well, I was going to explain that to the big guy. I was going to tell him, man, I had a problem with this alcohol. But I could tell that he was not really that interested in my point of view, and he was not that interested. I think one of the things, I found one of the things that as I stayed sober, one of the things I really enjoy doing is if something strikes me as sort of humorous or making a point, I always have started to enjoy passing on. Guy says, well, don't you ever risk when you're talking up in front of people about telling a story or something that they might have heard? And I said, well, no, because it ain't going to take that long. And anyhow, it's about the logic professor. And one of the big challenges when you tell that a little bit about your story, you don't want to make it too boring. Anyhow, he gets up in front of the class, and he says, first day of class in logic and deductive reasoning. He says, there's 60 seconds a minute, 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours a day. He says, how old am I? Nobody can answer it. It's boring and pompous. Took himself much too seriously. Second day, same question. He says, there's 60 seconds a minute, 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours a day. He says, how old am I? Nobody can answer the question. It went on every day for about a month. Same question, 60 seconds, 60 minutes, 24 hours, how old am I? Finally, at the end of about a month, a young man in the back class said, he said, sir. He said, yes. He said, sir, you are 44 years old. He says, that's absolutely right. What steps of logic and deductive reasoning did you use? He said, sir, I have a brother. My brother's crazy. My brother's in the mental institution. My brother's 22 years old, and you're twice as crazy as he is. Anyhow, I was going to tell that to the big guy. He wasn't listening to me. Sorry. I came home to Seattle, and I married that beautiful lady on April 1st in 1955. And I started in the spring quarter, University of Washington, 1956. I had a real first-class drinking problem. I thought, like everybody else has said, that when I got back and got normal, it would be okay. But it wasn't okay. And one morning, I'd been drunk for about 3 or 4 days, and I woke up about 7:30 in the morning. And I was supposed to be at work at 7:30. Because I picked up another drunk driving arrest, and I had five of them. And I knew I was going to I dropped out of university, and I went to work with my part-time employer full-time. I was supposed to be there at 7:30 in the morning. I lasted about 3 weeks in the spring quarter. And about 7:30, and I knew I was hungover, and I knew I was in trouble, and I knew I had a problem with my drinking. I started calling my wife's doctor about 7:30 and got the answering service about 8 o'clock, and I started drinking my way to work. And I'd call. I'd stop, and I'd drink, and then I'd call my wife's doctor. And then I'd drink a little while longer, call my wife's doctor, and I wanted to talk to him about my alcoholism, my drinking. And I was going to use that to tell my boss when I got to work that I was doing something about my drinking. And when I got there, by the time I got to work, it was about 12:30, and I was only 5 hours late, and I never did get my wife's doctor, and I often wondered what a gynecologist would know about alcoholism. My several thought about drinking. I don't think he'd probably know that much about it back in those days. Anyhow, I got to about 12:30, and my boss saw me. He just became enraged because he knew I dropped out of the university. He knew that I had this jail time pending, and he knew. He said, "Get out of here, you're fired." I said, "And you know what an incredible..." Now, this is the turn of the card. In the winter of 1955, 1956, my guy that became my sponsor had talked to a group of non-alcoholic businessmen. He had talked to a group of non-alcoholic businessmen, and he told the story of his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told what he was like, what happened, and what he's like now. And back then, they weren't talking around in the community so much, and more concerned about their anonymity. My sponsor, Eric, talked to this group of... My boss was in the audience. He was so impressed with Eric and the story of his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous that he went back to his place of business looking for an alcoholic to help. And when he found one, he fired me and sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I was going to tell the big guy. I was going to tell him, "Hey, listen, I got fired and sent here. That's how I came through the back door. But I learned one of the great, great, marvelous lessons. My boss hired me back right away." And they say when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't make any difference how you got here, but someday, early on, you better make it your idea. Because if you came to get her back, the first time she takes your meter out and reads it, you lash out. The only way an alcoholic knows how to do it. And my boss hired me back. He was a great boss, but he was just a little short on human relations. He did not know, and I love what Creighton said about feelings, because he did not know that I was a sensitive alcoholic. And after about a month, he came in and raised 48 kinds of cane with me about something and was quite severe, uncharitable to me. I lashed out the only way I knew how. That happened a couple of times in the spring of 1956. My sponsor, Eric, had made an interesting point over and over and over again. He said, "Somehow, you've got to do this for yourself. And then when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you've got to make it the most important single thing in your life. Make it more important than the job. Make it more important than the family. More important than recreation. More important than the church. More important than any other single thing. Make Alcoholics Anonymous a program, the most important single thing in your life for a relative period of time. For some, it's a year, for a year and a half, 2 years, 6 months. It varies from individual to individual. But from that day forward, when it's not the most important single thing in your life, one day at a time, your sobriety is the most important single thing." I said, "I understand that." And what I first time I at a friend of mine had told a story 20, 25 years ago, and I related it because Eric had made it very clear. Anyhow, it's about the company that's going to start the group insurance policy. An old story, but it makes a point that Eric was driving home. And then they're going to start a group insurance plan. The good news was companies were going to pay 95%. Bad news was that everybody had to sign up, and everybody did except the fellow out in the receiving department, Bill. Foreman spent 3 hours, explained it to him, absolutely. Wouldn't sign up. Superintendent spent another 4 hours with him, he still wouldn't sign. Group insurance man spent about 4 hours with him and said, even if you get your feelings hurt, we pay you. He wouldn't sign. President of the company called him in and said, Bill, sit down. He says, you either sign this or you're fired. Where do I sign? He says, it's right here. Walks out, there's a foreman, superintendent, group insurance man. He says, well, what happened? He says, well, I signed. He says, how come you signed for him and you wouldn't sign for us? He said, I never had it explained so clearly. And Eric said, make Alcoholics Anonymous the most important thing. So I quit him and went to work in a factory, and I made Alcoholics Anonymous the most important single thing in my life. And you see, most of us go through life looking for something, a sense of belonging, truly belonging somewhere, where we could feel deeply at ease, accepted, part of a family, surrounded by people who care. And when I made Alcoholics Anonymous the most important single thing in my life, that's exactly what I experienced. And I realized that for me, that sobriety in itself was enough. But it's pretty much an attitude. I think back to an old story that a friend of mine used to tell. About the two contractors that are talking. One says, how's it going out on the site? And he says, oh, I'm having trouble with the bricklayers. He says, how so? He says, well, I came to the first bricklayer and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm laying brick and I don't want you to hassle me. He says, what'd you do? He says, I fired him. I had a bad attitude. He says, so I came to the second bricklayer. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm a bricklayer and a mason. I'm laying brick. I appreciate it if you stay off my back. He said, what'd you do? He says, I fired him. And I said, well, what happens? I came to the next bricklayer. I said, what are you doing? He stood up. He looked me right in the eye and he said, sir, he says, I'm a mason and a craftsman and a member of the guild. And sir, I'm building a cathedral whose spires shall reach to the heaven and serve as a landmark in the city for posterity. And inside the narthex, people can come and heal their torn and broken spirit and find solace in their time of need. And his partner says, wow, that's beautiful. What'd you do? He says, man, I fired him. He's crazy. We're building a Shell gas station. I think that somehow he was trying to teach me. Eric was trying to teach me, my sponsor was trying to teach me, that it is basically an attitude. We had so much of the promises and referred to it. In the big book, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 83, it talks about the spiritual life as not a theory. We have to live it. We're going to know a new freedom. We're going to know a new freedom and happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And I really believe that in step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. In step 3, that's possible to us. I learned something after I've been sober for about 17 years. I call it the law of reverse effect. The law of reverse effect is when you try to sink, you float. When you try to float, you sink. That's one of the beautiful things that Bill talks about in so much of our literature when he says, in our surrender, we grow strong. And I believe that is sort of the law of reverse effect. In our surrender, we grow strong. Somebody had written that character is not made in a crisis, it is revealed. I've been sober for 17 years. And I worked in this factory for about a year and a half, and then I went to work for a real small company. I started as an assistant to an assistant who was an assistant. It was not a real responsible job. I worked my way up. The company grew very, very dramatically. Next 16 years. And it had about 23 branches around the United States and Canada, and I ended up as a national president. I reported to the chairman of the board. I was very active in the community, and then there's an interesting set of circumstances. My boss, who was the chairman of the board, got hit by a boat prop, took off one of his legs and chewed up the other one real bad. A whole series of events, financial events, economic events, happened about that time. And the company, I think back here in agricultural circles, we would call it a crop failure. And the company went sideways. There's an old expression I've used more than once that said, Ralph is okay as long as he has $1, but you give him $2 and he gets dangerous. And the company was in extremis. And as a corporate officer, I'd personally guaranteed the bank loan, the SBA loan, guaranteed much of the credit, the lines of credit to the officer of the corporation, although it was a publicly held corporation. We had a multitude of stockholders. But then the company was in extremis and was really in very severe financial straits, and they couldn't sue the company. My boss, he was completely wiped out, and I was the next person in line, and they started lining up. They were suing me with a high degree of regularity. I've been sober in 17 years. They were coming from every direction. And I remember this one really beautiful, classy guy as a classy attorney. He was a marvelous attorney. And he was just doing his job, and he was suing me and representing the person suing me. And he says, well, Ralph, it says here you have a nice home. I said, well, no, as a matter of fact, that's gone. He says, well, it says here that you have some personal effects worth some money. I said, no, as a matter of fact, that's gone. I says, well, he says you have some land here. I said, no, as a matter of fact, that's gone. He says, well, it says here you have some stock. And he's reading off the financial statement. I said, well, it's kind of old. And I said, no, as a matter of fact, that's gone. He said, do you have a job yet? And I said, no. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I started over. I'm going to start my own little business. And he said, why don't you get a job? And I said, well, you guys just come sue me and attach me and garnish me and get a judgment and I'd get fired. He said, do you have anything rat-holed? I said, no, as a matter of fact, it's all gone. Everything is gone. He says, where do you live? I said, my wife and our three teenagers and I live in a rented two-bedroom house. He says, how do you, are you making any money yet? I said, no. He said, you sure you don't have any money? I said, no. He said, how do you support yourself? I said, well, last 2 weeks, we have a daughter, Sherry, 16 years old. She's a counter girl at Dairy Queen. The last 2 weeks, I borrowed $75 a week from her for groceries. And it was at that moment that I realized that sobriety was enough. It was at that point that I realized that so much of what we attach so much significance to is meaningless. And it was a sort of a quiet moment between the attorney and me, and he said, that'll be all, and he said, you may go. I thanked him, and I was a little distressed at the moment, but it was not without its lighter moments or more poignant moments. There was one attorney, she was a lady, it was a marvelous attorney, most effective, thorough, wonderful. She got a straddle me like I had never been in my entire life, and she was being quite severe. And I was talking to her. By this time, I'd kind of gotten settled down a little bit in all of this thing, and I said, no, let me get this straight. Let's see, we lost the home, we lost the business, we lost the property, lost everything that I own, sold our personal effects, and now you say you're going to make trouble for me. She was so beautiful, she could have taught the mafia how to fight dirty. But see, I tell you, if I ever had anything to collect ever in my entire life, I would find her. I would seek her out because she was just so beautifully effective and thorough. And I said, and it was one of the few class things that I've ever done, and I waited to fit it into the conversation. Anyhow, I just said to her very gently, I said, listen, I understand you're just doing your job, and I love you, and I'll see you later. And she slammed that receiver, that phone down so hard about tore my ear off. She didn't even say goodbye. And it took me 10.5 years to work back out of the quicksand. It took me 10.5 years to pay off the SBA banks. I chose not to pull the plug. It took me 11 years to pay off the major bank and the deal, and extricate myself from that. But what I realized from all of it was that you and I, when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then we start through this process of staying sober, nobody is guaranteed that you and I are going to be forever out of the quicksand. But the thing that I understood about all of this was that it was enough for me to stay sober and to attach significance. It says also on that page 83 that you and I are going to lose our fear of economic uncertainty. I don't happen to recommend that way of doing it. But if I live to be 100 one day at a time, I never have to worry about that part of my life again. I think that one of the things that I've really particularly appreciated in my sobriety, I thought earlier, and when you had people like Linda Creighton and Mindy and Charles last night, and all of you must have gotten this feeling sometime, when you follow those people and you're playing in the first team like that, I felt so like the third team, I'm going to be playing with these guys. Huh? And I'm thinking, and I thought back, and I get to tell it because I'm here. And anyhow, and this being football country, I enjoyed telling anyhow, a pal of mine told me a few years ago, anyhow, out there we used to have the cross state. Our state of Washington has got a range of mountains right down the middle of it. It's called the Cascade Range. And we used to play east against the west on Thanksgiving Day. It's big football. Anyhow, it's a Thanksgiving Day football. And it's for the state championship. And there's 2 minutes left to play, and the coach calls over the third-string quarterback, and he said, that's me, third-string. He says, come here, kid. He says, listen, real close, kid. He says, there's 2 minutes left to play. He says, we got the ball on our own 2-yard line. He says, listen real closely, kid. He says, I tell you, he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go in on the first play, hold it for a quarterback sneak, second play, hold it for a quarterback sneak, third play, hold it for a quarterback sneak, and the fourth play, just kick that ball as far as you can, and maybe we can salvage this 14-14 tie. He says, you got that, kid? He says, yeah. 14-14, hold it, kick it. I got it. First play goes in, picks up 37 yards. Second play on a quarterback sneak, he picks up 42 yards. Third play on a quarterback sneak, he picks up, takes it all the way down to the opponent's 1-yard line. And sure enough, on the fourth play, he kicks that ball all the way up in the 52nd row of the stand. By this time, the gun sounds, the game ends tied, 14-14. The kid's walking off the field, his coach says, come here, kid. He said, what in the world were you thinking about when you kicked that ball? He said, I was thinking, what a stupid coach we have. When I had got my program back together and stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a beautiful friend in AA. He gave me a line that I've heard many times since then. But the line was that he was encouraging me to find some depth in the spiritual part of the program. He said, you've got to form this attachment. He said, there's a little quirk in human nature. He says, it's just natural, it's so human for all of us to return when we're an extremist, when life hands us a foul ball, we're going to return to the last thing that gave us comfort. And he said, staying sober is just, that's great. But he said, he encouraged me to form some, to at least become aware of the spiritual part of the program. And he said, you and I revert when we're an extremist, when we get knocked off our feet, get knocked off balance, when we put it in the ditch, we'll revert to the last thing that gave us comfort. He said, that's why some people, if they have nothing else to hold on to, when they get knocked aside for whatever reason, they revert to drinking. Or they go back to pills, or food, or alcohol. or they immerse themselves in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he encouraged me. And one of the things that helped me about as much as anything else, I was at the, we have a Friday night meeting, had for years, and used to go to it often. And this one particular Friday night, I did not go home right from work. There was something else happening, and then I went to the meeting. It is about 8, then at 8:30 at night. So I got home about 10:30 at night, one of those kind of unusual evenings in Seattle. It was raining. That was a little joke there. They said a day without sunshine is 9 months in Seattle. Anyhow, it was kind of a dark, cold, rainy night, and I was tired. And I got home, and my wife was kind of dozing by the television, and this guy had been talking at the big hall. And he talked about a very simple lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, we stand up, we say the serenity prayer at the outset. And then at the end, he said, for all these years, I've been parroting the Lord's Prayer. He says, if you're going to say it, like he's talking to me, if you're going to say it, so rather than just a parrot, why don't you think about what you're saying, what you're experiencing? Think about it. And so I wrote that. I was so taken with what he was saying, I wrote it. There was a napkin on the table, and I wrote it. My ballpoint pen went through it, and I still have that old napkin. And I got home then about 10:30, and I let my wife know that I was home, and she's kind of dozing by the television. And our daughter, who was then about 8, our other daughter was then 7, and our little son, John, was 5. And I didn't go right in where they were sleeping. I went in, and that day, just how many years ago, we got a book called Great Lives and Great Deeds. And I read about Madame Curie. I just sat down and still had my half marine coat on. My wife was still dozing out there, and the kids were sleeping. And I read about Madame Curie, and then I read about Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, how his daughter had meningitis and died when she was 19. And his little son, who he revered, Langdon Cubby. And I read, so I was spring-loaded for what happened next. I was really spring-loaded. Spring-loaded by what happened at the meeting. And then I read that short biographical sketch of Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, and about his little boy who died when he was under 2. He just revered that little boy. And I went in, and our little kids, when they were little, they're like your little kids. But when they were asleep, they were like angels. And when they were awake, there was something else. And Sherry didn't wake up, and Cindy didn't wake up. And well, I went in, John, he woke up and gave me a big hug, and that was worth the price of admission. And I experienced what the person was thinking, talking about. If I'm going to parrot the Lord's Prayer, Our Father which art in heaven, maybe I ought to think about it. And I thought, because then I'd been sober about 9 years. I was sober just about a year when Cher was born. So I was experiencing my sobriety and starting to become aware of this need to develop in a spiritual way. Because you see, my father was an alcoholic too. My father died on Skid Row in Seattle in the Hollywood Hotel. When I was 14 years old, my mother took myself and my 16-year-old brother, she just left, that she'd had enough. And he was a wonderful guy. And I linked the two together. You see, my father, even though he died on Skid Row, died in the Hollywood Hotel, he was the one guy in my life who made me feel important. I don't know why, but my brother was older, my mother always seemed to be closer to him. I was always my dad's boy. He made me feel important. Always made me feel like I was bright, like I was super, like I was special. And he'd go out of his way to kind of fit me into the conversation. He'd go out of his way to let me know that he thought that I was very, very bright and that I had some potential. Except for his alcoholism. And he'd get drunk and he'd lay drunk for 3 and 4 weeks at a time until that whole house smelled. And she finally left. And he'd come by the newsstand. I sold papers at 3rd and Pine in Seattle from the Bon Marché. And he'd come by and he'd be so sick, and he knew I'd always had money in my apron, and he'd borrow a dollar. He'd pay it back. One time at Christmas, he came and took me up and bought me a turkey dinner. We didn't have that much to talk about. And then he died. And the thought occurred to me, in spite of the fact that he died in Skid Row, he intended good things for me. He intended for me to have this beautiful life that I found in my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thought occurred to me that with all of his frailties, if he intended good things for me, the odds are greater than even our Father, which art in heaven, probably intends good things for me too. Just seemed to make sense. And that's what I wrote on the napkin. And that's what I experienced when John woke up. Well, what happened then? As I finally worked my way out of the quicksand, and Sherry, a little counter girl, she grew up, she's 30, 31, now she's a beautiful young lady. She got married, and somebody asked me, what's it like when your first daughter gets married like that, and your beautiful child gets married to this guy? I said, well, I don't know, it's kind of like giving a Stradivarius to a gorilla. Somebody told her, her husband. He didn't laugh. Oh, he's beautiful. He knows I love him very much, and I'm very proud of him. And I just, because they have given us our first grandchild, little Melissa. The counter girl is now a mother, and she has little Melissa. Melissa's so incredibly, she's kind of beautiful, and we have a special relationship. I heard a psychologist one time talk. He says, the reason why there's such an incredible relationship between the grandfather and the granddaughter is because you skip a generation. And you can communicate with each other, but that's not the reason. The reason is that we have this beautiful relationship to the grandfather and granddaughter is because we have a common enemy. I told Sherry, she laughs. She knows I love her so much. Her sister's married too, and she's hopefully going to give us number two, and her little brother John is married. And so worked her way back up out of the quicksand, and my wife, and I guess next week is going to be April 1st, rather fitting, and it'll be 33 years together. And it all comes back. There's a couple things I learned. There may be somebody here that's going through some kind of a struggle. I read a line. I wish it was so beautiful. I wish I could say it was mine. It's not. We have problems with the boss, and we have problems with the job, and we have problems around us, and we experience some losses. All losses, and the line was, all losses are short-term. All losses are short-term. The big game goes on. And I realized that one day at a time, new business prospered, and my wife and I have a home again, and but a whole different marvelous value system. And the fourth point of view that went with the other three was that, yes, I didn't want to die yet. Couldn't safely drink again. Had to learn to be nicer to people. But then I realized that I never had to buy into the other person's game. If for whatever reason they wanted to be severe, I never had to take it personally. So I loved Creighton. I just wanted to go put my arms around him and tell him when he talked about feelings, the sensitive alcoholic. Because you see, when this beautiful lady, that attorney, God, I just love her because she reminded me of my sobriety. You see, as alcoholics, by the time we got here, we've already done so many things. We've lost our confidence. We've done so many things to ourselves. I'd been beat up, fired. I had lost my confidence. I'll spare you the details. And you're going to make trouble for me? No. Well, I love you, but you can't do that because I've already made enough trouble for myself. I don't have to buy into it anymore. It's a marvelous, marvelous awareness. And that became the fourth thing that has kind of helped me, so I don't have to become distressed anymore. And when I was with him up in Moorhead, I told a story. Cease liked it so well, and he was there, come down from Prince Albert. He called me about a month later, and he says, tell me again that story. And I said, well, Steve, I know you're going to use it, but I'll tell it to you anyhow. And I would use it as I close, because it has to do with... Anyhow, little Jimmy, and he starts bawling his dad. He says, Dad, I want a baby sister. Dad says, you want a baby sister, you have to pray for one. That night he goes to bed and prays real hard. Next morning he comes down and says, where's my baby sister? He says, you want a baby sister, you'll have to pray real hard for one. And you'll have to keep praying. And that night he goes to bed and prays for all he's worth, about 20 seconds worth. And the next morning he comes down and says, where's my baby sister? He says, you'll have to keep praying. And little Jimmy forgot all about it. About 6-7 months later, in the middle of the night, his dad woke him up, helped him out of his pajamas, into the street clothes, put him in the car, took him downtown, up the back stairs of the hospital, and there in the hospital room was his mother. And under her right arm, all dressed in pink, was a beautiful baby sister. And his dad takes him by the hand and takes him around the other side of the bed. And there, under her other arm, all dressed in pink, was another beautiful baby sister. His father says, Jimmy, aren't you glad you prayed? And he says, yes, Dad, and aren't you glad I quit when I did? There you go.